The stone falcons have returned to roost, Layla St. John agreed softly. But that is not all Amlimo's prophecy. She foresaw that the man who brought the falcons back to Zimbabwe would rule the land as once did the Mambos and Monomotapas, as once did your ancestors Lobengula and great Mzilikazi. Tungata turned slowly to face her once more. That is a secret that you and I share, Comrade Leela. It will remain our secret, Comrade Tungata. But you and I both know that there will be need during the difficult years that lie ahead for a man as strong as Mzilikazi was strong. Tungata did not reply. He looked up into the branches of the ancient tree, and his lips moved in a silent supplication. Then he replaced the gold-rimmed glasses over his eyes and turned back to Layla. "The car is waiting," he said. It was a black bulletproof Mercedes 500. There were four police motorcycle outriders and a second, smaller Mercedes for his bodyguards. The small convoy drove very fast, with the police sirens shrieking and wailing and the colourful little ministerial pennant fluttering on the front of Tungata's Mercedes. They went down the 3-kilometre-long jacaranda-lined driveway that Cecil Rhodes had designed as the approach to his state house, and then crossed the main commercial section of Bulawayo, flying through the red lights at the junctions to the geometrical grid of roads and avenues, past the town square where the wagons had lagered during the rebellion when Butso's impis had threatened the town, down along the wide avenue that bisected the meticulously groomed lawns of the public gardens, and at last turned off sharply and drew up in front of the modern 3-storey museum building. There was a red carpet laid down the front steps of the museum, and a small gathering of dignitaries headed by the mayor of Bulawayo, the first Matabele ever to hold that position, and the curator of the museum. "Welcome, Comrade Minister, on this historic occasion." They escorted him down the long corridor to the public auditorium. Every seat was already filled, and as Tungata entered, the entire gathering stood and applauded him, the whites in the gathering outdoing the Matabele as a positive demonstration of their goodwill. Tungata was introduced to the other dignitaries on the speaker's platform. "This is Dr. van der Walt, curator of the Southern African Museum." He was a tall, balding man with a heavy South African accent. Tungata shook hands with him briefly and unsmilingly. This man represented a nation that had actively opposed the People's Republican Army's march to glory. Tungata turned to the next in line. She was a young white woman, and she was immediately familiar to Tungata. He stared at her sharply, not quite able to place her. She had gone very pale under his scrutiny, and her eyes were dark and terrified as those of a hunted animal. The hand in his was limp and cold and trembled violently. Still, Tungata could not decide where he had seen her before. "Dr. Carpenter is the curator of the entomological section." The name meant nothing to Tungata, and he turned away from her, irritated by his own inability to place her. He took his seat in the centre of the platform facing the auditorium, and the South African Museum's curator rose to address the gathering. "All the credit for the successful negotiation of the exchange between our two institutions must go to the Honourable Minister, who today honours us with his presence." He was reading from a typed sheet, clearly anxious to have done speaking and sit down again. "It was at Minister Tungata Zabiwe's initiative that discussions first took place, and he sustained these during the difficult period when we appeared to be making little or no progress. Our great problem was in setting a relative value on two such diverse exhibits. On one hand, you had one of the world's most extensive and exhaustive collections of tropical insects, representing many decades of dedicated collecting and classification, while on the other hand, we had these unique artifacts from an unknown civilization." Van der Walt seemed to be warming to his subject, enough to look up from his prepared script. "However, it was the Honourable Minister's determination to regain for his new nation a priceless part of its heritage that at last prevailed. And it is to his credit entirely that we are gathered here today." When at last van der Walt sat down again There was a polite splattering of applause, and then an expectant silence as Tungata Zabiwe rose to his feet. The minister had an immense presence, and without yet uttering a word, he transfixed them with his smoky, unwavering gaze. "My people have a saying that was passed down from the wise ones of our tribe," he started in his deep, rumbling voice. "It is this: the white eagle has stooped on the stone falcons and cast them to earth. Now the eagle shall lift them up again, and they will fly far. There shall be no peace in the kingdoms of the Mambos or the Monomotapas until they return. For the white eagle will war with the black bull until the stone falcons return to roost." Tungata paused a moment, letting his words hang between them, heavy with portent. Then he went on. "I am sure all of you here know the story of how the bird statues of Zimbabwe were seized by Rhodes's plunderers, and despite the efforts of my ancestors to prevent it, how they were carried away southwards across the Limpopo River." Tungata left the podium and strode to the curtained-off section at the back of the speaker's platform. "My friends, my comrades," he turned to face them once more, "the stone falcons have returned to roost," he said, and drew aside the curtains. There was a long, breathless silence, and the audience stared avidly at the serried ranks of tall soapstone carvings that were revealed. There were six of them, and they were those that Ralph Ballantyne had lifted from the ancient stone temple, the one that his father had taken on his first visit to Zimbabwe 30 years before had burned in the pyre of Krutaskur. These six were all that remained. The soapstone from which each of the birds was carved was of a greenish, satiny texture. Each bird crouched on top of a plinth that was ornamented by a pattern of intermeshed triangles, like the teeth in a shark's jaw. The statues were not identical. Some of the columns supported crocodiles and lizards that crawled up towards the bird image that surmounted it. Some of the statues had been extensively damaged, chipped and eroded. But the one in the centre of the line was almost perfect. The bird was a stylized raptor, with its long, blade-like wings crossed over its back. The head was proud and erect, the cruel beak hooked, and the blind eyes haughty and unforgiving. It was a magnificent and evocative work of primitive art, and the crowded auditorium rose as one person in spontaneous applause. Tungata Zabiwe reached out and touched the head of the central bird. His back was turned to the audience, so they could not see his lips move, and the applause drowned his voice. "Welcome home," he whispered. "Welcome home to Zimbabwe, bird of my destiny." "Now you do not want to go?" Janine was shaking with fury. "After all the pains I have gone to arrange this meeting, now you simply do not want to go?"
"Jan, it's a waste of time."
"Thank you." She put her face closer to his. "Thank you for that. Do you realize what it would cost me to face that monster again? But I was prepared to do it for you, and now it's a waste of time. Jan, please." "Damn you, Craig Miller. It's you who are a waste of time. You and your endless cowardice." He gasped and drew away from her. "Cowardice," she repeated deliberately. "I say that, and I mean it. You were in too much of a blue funk to send that bloody book of yours to a publisher. I had literally to tear it away from you and send it off." She broke off, panting with anger, searching for words sharp enough to express her fury. "You're afraid to face life, afraid to leave this cave you have built for yourself, afraid to take the chance of somebody rejecting your book, afraid to make any effort to float this thing you've built." With a wide, extravagant gesture, she indicated the yacht. "I see it now. You don't really want to get into the ocean. You prefer to hide here, swilling gin and covering yourself with dreams. You don't want to walk. You prefer to drag yourself around on your backside. It's your excuse, your grand cast-iron excuse to dodge life." Again, she had to stop for breath. And then she went on. "That's right. Put that little boy look on your face. Make those big sad eyes. It works every time, doesn't it? Well, not this time, Buster. Not this time. They have offered me the job of curator at the South African Museum. I am to see the collection safely installed in its new home, and I'm going to take it. Do you hear me, Craig Mellor? I'm going to leave you to crawl around on the floor because you're too damn scared to stand up. She flung herself out of the saloon and into the forward cabin. She began to snatch her clothes out of the stowage and throw them onto the bunk. Jan, he said behind her. What is it now? She did not look around. If we're going to be there by 3 o'clock, then we'd better leave right away, Craig said. You can drive, she said, and pushed past him and went up to the cockpit, leaving him to follow at his best speed. They drove in silence until they reached the entrance to the long straight avenue of jacaranda trees. At the far end of it were the white gates of State House, and Janine stared straight ahead at them. I'm sorry, Craig. I said things that were hard to say and must have been harder to listen to. The truth is that I am as afraid as you are. I'm going to face the man that destroyed me. If I can do it, then perhaps I can retrieve something of myself from the ruins. I lied when I said it was for you. It's for both of us. The police guard came to the driver's side of the maroon Land Rover, and without a word, Craig handed him the appointment card. The constable checked it against his visitor's book, and then made Craig fill in his name and address and the reason for his visit. Craig wrote, "Visit to Comrade Minister Tungata Zabiwe," and the guard took the book back from him and saluted smartly. The wrought iron gate swung open, and Craig drove through. They turned left towards the minister's annex, with just a glimpse of the white gables and blue slate roof of the main residence between the trees. Craig parked the Land Rover in the public car park and slid into the wheelchair. Janine walked beside him to the steps that led up onto the veranda of the annex, and there was an awkward moment while Craig negotiated them by the sheer strength of his arms. Then they followed the signs down the trestled veranda. Beneath the blue wisteria and climbing purple bougainvillea, to the door of the antechamber. One of the minister's bodyguards searched Janine's handbag, frisked Craig quickly but expertly, and then stood aside to let them enter the light and airy room. There were lighter square patches on the walls from where the portraits of previous white administrators and politicians had been removed. The only wall decoration now were two flags draped on either side of the inner double doors, the flags of Zipra and of the New Zimbabwe Nation. Craig and Janine waited for almost half an hour, and then the doors opened and another suited bodyguard came through. "The Comrade Minister will see you now." Craig wheeled himself forward and into the inner room. On the facing wall were portraits of the nation's leaders, Robert Mugabe and Josiah Nkunzi. In the centre of the wall-to-wall carpeting stood a huge desk in the style of Louis XIV. Tungata Zabiwe sat behind his desk, and even its size could not belittle him. Involuntarily, Craig stopped halfway to the desk. "Sam?" he whispered. "Samson Kumalo? I did not know. I'm sorry." The minister stood up abruptly. Craig's shock was reflected in his own face. "Craig," he whispered, "what happened to you?" "The war," Craig answered. "I guess I was on the wrong side, Sam." Tungata recovered swiftly and sat down again. "That name is best forgotten," he said quietly. "Just as what we were once to each other should also be forgotten. You made an appointment through Dr. Carpenter to see me. What was it that you wished to discuss?" Tungata listened attentively while Craig spoke, and then he leaned back in his chair. "From what you tell me, you have already made an application to the Exchange Control Authority for a permit to export this vessel of yours. That permit was refused?" "That is correct, Comrade Minister," Craig nodded. "Then what made you think I would want to or even have the authority to countermand that decision?" Tungata asked. "I didn't really think you would," Craig admitted. "Comrade Minister," Janine spoke for the first time, "I asked for this appointment because I believe that there are special circumstances in this case. Mr. Mellor has been crippled for life, and his only possession is this vessel.